This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 7th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and what we're going to look at this week will be the developments that took place in this week in federal taxes. We're going to talk about an IRS interesting loss on a charitable contribution issue that's somewhat unique. I've not seen the IRS actually raise this issue. And the IRS loses, which I guess is good news for us. IRS gave some comprehensive guidance on a number of provisions found in the SECURE Act and one that passed at the same time as the SECURE Act you may not have paid attention to because it was sitting in a whole different section of that big year-end appropriations bill that went through. We'll talk about a draft 941. The second change in 941 form in the year is coming out. We have a new draft form to deal with the payroll tax holiday issues. We'll talk about a minister that discovered he hadn't had any money paid in for Social Security or Medicare for 21 years, and he didn't qualify for benefits. And we'll talk about how that works and some confusion about how you handle reporting for ministers. And finally, we'll talk about the IRS putting up a webpage that gives information on the new Bipartisan Budget Act Centralized Partnership Audit Regime, our new guidance there. Let's roll into our first case, though, which will be the case of Dickinson versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2020-128. This deals with a concept that we use quite often in individual tax planning, where you have an individual who has a highly appreciated asset that he or she would like to make a contribution to charity. If we can use that highly appreciated asset, we kill two birds with one stone. We get out of having to recognize that gain on selling that asset if we were to sell it, but on Schedule A, we still get to treat that contribution at full fair value. So we're much better off than selling the asset and contributing the cash. But in this case, the IRS sought to attack such a contribution. This taxpayer made a contribution of closely held stock to a donor advised fund, actually Fidelity's donor advised fund, that I've worked with, I think a lot of you probably worked with over time, had clients made contributions to that fund. Now, Fidelity has no interest whatsoever in holding stock in a closely held company. So prior to this contribution being made, you had to essentially assure that there would be some way that Fidelity could sell this stock off and convert it to something that they were willing to hold. So they essentially had the board of directors approved that if somebody made a contribution to the donor advised fund for Fidelity, that the board is willing to redeem those shares should Fidelity ask for redemption. Now, that's a pretty standard structure for things like these, you know, larger donor advised funds. They certainly don't want to hold that closely held stock. And honestly, it's questionable whether any charity really could long-term hold such a high-risk, illiquid asset. You know, they would want to be moving that to something that doesn't quite have that odd criteria and eventually want to use that for a charitable purpose. So probably we need to liquidate whatever it is. But the IRS got concerned and said, well, wait a minute. We think that because of all this and how this was structured, that in reality, this was not a contribution of shares from the taxpayer to Fidelity to the charity, but rather it was really a redemption of a portion of the taxpayer's shares by the company for which the taxpayer would pay tax, followed by a contribution to the charity. So they weren't really attacking the contribution per se, but they were wanting the taxpayer to pick this up as gain. This is interesting because, to be totally honest, this is not that unusual of a situation. And while this involved a donor advised fund, almost any situation where a taxpayer would look to make a charitable contribution of closely held stock would involve very similar circumstances. A charity's not going to be too keen on taking on such a contribution unless they can figure out some way to convert it to an asset they can do something with to serve their charitable purpose. You know, they're not sitting there to provide long-term holding for a, you know, interest in some closely held company that they'll have a minority interest in. So this was a serious potential challenge, something I had not seen the IRS actually try to do recently. And It actually, we find out they haven't done it quite a while because the tax court went back to a case that goes back to 1964. Humacid versus Commissioner, 42 TC 894, a 1964 case. And the court said, based on that ruling of that case and a related case that comes up later that we look at here, and hopefully I can get my, there it is, Palmer versus Commissioner, 62 TC 684 from 1974, 10 years later. We have a pair of cases that dealt with a situation like this. When does it work? And the tax court said, well, we're going to respect the form of the transaction. That is, there was a donation of shares to Fidelity, followed by Fidelity, once they had the shares, making a sale, you know, of those shares, which wouldn't be taxable to Fidelity. And we'll respect that. We're not going to swap it and say it's something different, so long as two criteria are met. First, the taxpayer has to have given away the property absolutely, parts with title entirely. So actual ownership is put in the hands of the charity. And this has to take place prior to when, you know, the property would have been given rise to income by way of a sale, meaning that you really can't have a deal where the taxpayer is just about, you know, we know the company is going to be sold, right? In fact, the deal is pretty much done. You know, we're going to sign it this afternoon. We're not allowed to just throw those shares over to the charity when we know everything's done and we're going to have a redemption to assign it over. So the court looked at this situation and said, you know what? We looked at it this way. First thing, he clearly gave all interest in the stock. That was clearly transferred to Fidelity. It's not as if he held on to it or somehow he kept control of those shares. Those shares were truly transferred. So we don't see any problem saying that, in essence, Fidelity never really owned the shares. And secondly, the court said there's a fundamental problem, IRS, with your argument that this was effectively an assignment of income from the taxpayer to the charity. Because that's really what the second prong of the test is looking for. You know, are we just trying to assign our income to a tax-exempt entity to get out of paying it? And the court found that no, because here's the quirk in this case. If the taxpayer in this case had held on to the shares, if Dickinson had not given them to the charity, then the closely held company would not have redeemed the shares. There would have been no redemption without the contribution to Fidelity. So it was not the case that Mr. Dickinson avoided paying tax on a gain that he otherwise would have paid tax on, because had he not made the contribution, he would not have held on to those funds. Rather, it was transferred, and only after the shares were in the hands of a charity was the company willing to redeem the shares. So the court said this is a fundamentally different structure from what we've seen when we've talked about effectively assigning income. Now, there's also an interesting and somewhat confusing discussion about the court going back and saying, well, you know, the taxpayer and the IRS were arguing that Revenue Ruling 78-197 decided the case. Well, that ruling was where the service dealt with the case mentioned earlier, Palmer, and that told us that the IRS will treat the proceeds of redemption of stock under facts similar to those in Palmer as income to the donor only if the donee is legally bound or can be compelled by the corporation to surrender the shares for redemption. Now, the IRS claimed that, oh, this meant that this was like Palmer, you know, not like Palmer, but this was, you know, essentially a taxable event to the shareholder. And the shareholder said, no, no, it's not. And they were fighting over whether that was that legally bound and compelled move. And I frankly think, honestly, as the court pointed out, they weren't. But the court also pointed out an important issue here. The court said that the tax court has never adopted this revenue ruling as binding on the court. That the court looks to the case law here, thinking it perfectly well deals with the issue, and never has accepted this particular revenue ruling. Now, it's important to note because it tells you something about the pecking order of these rulings in the world. The revenue rulings are of a lower stage of, let's say, authority than are certain other items. So while a revenue ruling probably does bind the IRS, if you could show legitimately, you know, how that legitimately this is the position that the IRS has stated. They may or may not, the tax court's been kind of iffy on whether they would hold the IRS to the position, although for the most part they do now. The courts of appeal, though, have been very open about the fact that, yeah, sorry, IRS, you published this. This isn't just merely your litigating position you're thinking of doing. This is something that if it works in the favor of the taxpayer, you're bound by if the other side wants to use it. But the court did point out that, yeah, they're not necessarily following 78-197. Now, the concern about this is fairly simple. Is the IRS actually going to start challenging any time you try to make a charitable contribution of closely held stock? Hopefully, this loss will discourage the agents from doing this. But I frankly, when I saw the facts initially, I would have thought that, you know, we'd have finished this off as soon as you said, well, it's an agent who's clearly just, you know, kind of gone rogue on the agency. And once we talk to the supervisor, and certainly once we get to appeals, or if worse comes to worse, you go to tax court and the counsel's office gets involved, that they'll see the folly of their ways and they won't push it. But in this case, it got pushed all the way to court. So I don't know if there are other of these exams out there, if the service is going to look to appeal this, or what's going on and what the service is concerned about. But it's an interesting case just because it exists. Now, we did get some major guidance out this week. This is by far the most significant thing that happened this week, which is Notice 2020-68. This came out on September the 2nd. And this particular case, or this particular notice, deals with a number of issues related to qualified retirement plans and IRAs under the SECURE Act. And actually, well, it's really under the entire year-end tax program. We're going to discover that one part of this comes out of the Bipartisan American Miners Act of 2019, which was also part of that year-end appropriations package. But we'll talk about these provisions. The IRS issues some questions and answers to help implement all of these changes. Remember, we had major changes in retirement plans and IRAs made by the SECURE Act. Now, I realize in the interim, the COVID-19 situation, the CARES Act, and everything else has kind of gotten us to forget about this, but this stuff's still out there and it's still going to happen. So we do need to worry about it right now. So the first thing they did here was in the notice 2020-68, they talked about a section here dealing with the business credit for an automatic contribution arrangement. And it's actually called an eligible automatic contribution arrangement, or EACA is what they'll call it, all throughout the notice where they do it. And they set a series of questions and answers. And this is the idea where when an employee comes into a retirement plan, a 401k plan, where they have a right, where there is a deferral option, so a plan of deferral option, that there is a tax credit provided if an employer will add that to their plan. Congress wants to encourage employers to kind of make it the default, that if you don't say anything, we're going to save for retirement for you under this schedule, which also can become way more aggressive under the SECURE Act. And they actually are going to give you a credit for up to 3 years for some of the expenses the employer is going to incur making this change. This talks about that credit under Section 45T, answers a few issues. Now, like they say, you're eligible for it for 3 years. And they want to clarify, well, that's a single three-year period that begins running the year you adopt the EACA. So it's not as if you can adopt an EACA for this plan, terminate it, then maybe 6 years later, add one in again and start running the last 2 years. Only a single three-year period qualifies, and once you start the clock, it doesn't stop. So if you establish that provision in your 2020 plan, then you have to, then basically 2021, 22 are the only years you ever could get this credit. And it doesn't matter if you terminate that EACA before the years are done, you're not going to be able to open it back up again. And that's what they also say. They say you can't really change it or switch to a new plan. Your EACA has to be pretty much unchanged going forward. Now, they do give an example of how rather than terminating the plan, you put the EACA in and establishing a new plan that would then establish a new EACA, you could take the existing plan and potentially split it into pieces and continue the EACA provision unchanged in one half of the plan we split into, and then have a second plan that ran differently. So you do talk about potentially doing that to solve this issue if you really don't want, if you want to kind of have a plan that's not going to be covered by it, but they don't let you terminate the current plan and do a brand new one. That's not allowed for this purpose. Okay, that's what we've got. They also tell you if you are a, if you're in a multiple employer plan, the MEPs, MEPs can qualify for this. They have examples of how that would work if you were in a multiple employer plan, how you're going to be able to do it. Each employer runs separately in the MEP status. So some could qualify, some, you know, might not. Some might have had pre-existing, etc. So each employer in an MEP runs on their own. It's not as if the MEP runs for everybody under one set of rules, and either we all qualify or none do. So they tell us about that side of it and how that's going to work. They then go on and talk about the special new rules for contributions to a retirement plan or to an IRA, traditional IRA, after age 70 and a half. Now, this is the one that says, remember, it used to be that in the year in which you turned age 70 and a half, prior to 2020, you could no longer make a contribution to a traditional IRA. You could make a contribution to a Roth IRA. That's never been limited by age 70 and a half. You still have to have the earned income, and that's true for this as well, or your spouse does. But now you can keep going beyond that age. Now, this gives us some guidance in this area. And first, it makes it clear one thing, though. An IRA custodian does not have to actually allow you to make this contribution. Now, what that means is you might have to go open up a new IRA. If your custodian, whoever it may be, you know, whatever, you know, 12th National Bank, hopefully there is no such thing, so I'm not referring to some real institution. But if you have your plan with 12th National Bank, and 12th National Bank decides we're not going to allow this because we don't want to mess with it, you can't force them to take the contribution. So the custodian has to decide they're going to do it. And if they do decide they're going to do it, they have to modify their IRA agreement, their contract they have with you. And that modified agreement also has to be everybody who has the account or is benefiting from an account has to be given a copy of that new agreement. So if, in fact, your IRA custodian is going to accept this at some point, you will get this new agreement. Now, we have some time to wait before the things have to be amended. They can start accepting now if they commit to revising in the future. So that'll be one of the issues. Now, they also said some people have thought, hey, maybe, you know, if I'm over age 70 and a half, so I have like a $60,000 distribution coming out this year, can I make a $5,000 contribution to the IRA that's deductible? Okay. Well, can I just record a net $55,000 distribution? And they say no. Nope, you have to report the two separately. The two do run separately. They're independent. You would test deductions. I think the thing that we're concerned about here is somebody might try to do that, net the two, who was in a position where their traditional IRA contribution would be non-deductible. Or it'd be partially non-deductible, that this would take it out of that calculation. Turns out, no, you can't do that. So you can't net it. You can't do those sorts of things. You have to do them both. They're separate. They also give an example here of that special rule. If you make any contribution beginning in the year you turn 70 and a half, right, all the way forward, if you do that, if you try to make a qualified charitable distribution directly to a charity from your IRA, which remember, past age 70 and a half, you're allowed to do. But if you do that, you cannot do that until you have essentially paid tax on distributions up to your post 70 and a half, age 70 and a half contributions. So effectively, they give an example of how that works. So the idea being, if I put $5,000 in the year I turned age 70 and a half, 2 years later, I want to make a $10,000 qualified charitable distribution from the IRA, I will have to recognize $5,000 of income and then theoretically treat that as a $5,000 cash contribution to the charity before I could just treat it as not part of income and directly, you know, and directly to the charity. So it's not part of income, not deduction. Of course, the advantage of qualified charitable distribution is twofold. Number one, it reduces your AGI, which can qualify you for some benefits you couldn't otherwise qualify for tax-wise. But number two, what it also does, which is significant, is it goes ahead and allows you to take the charitable contribution effectively without having to itemize. And these days, especially if your retiree client has paid off their mortgage and we have the $10,000 cap on taxes, unless they're making other charitable contributions to get themselves up high enough to cover their standard deduction, which is going to be over $26,000, this may be the only way to get a benefit for a good chunk of that charitable contribution they plan to make. Contributions could be more than one. The QCD rules are helpful for that because it goes directly over and reduces the required minimum distribution. That's how they're often used. That's why Congress put this recapture rule in to say if you're going to make those contributions after you retire, we are going to penalize you with this. You can't then do a QCD to carry it out of the account without essentially having to pick it up as income. Otherwise, you could move effectively every year, so you get earned income, up to the maximum contribution amount to the IRA. You could move that much charitable contributions above the line, and they didn't want to allow you to do that. Congress said that's not what we're setting this up for. They also have here just one question deals with the rules for this new mandatory coverage for long-term part-time employees, which is found under Section 401k2D. That mandatory coverage of long-term part-time employees, those who have been with you for 3 years or more and had 500 hours or more of service. There is a quirky rule that was part of that where Congress said, even though it comes into play in 2021, you do not have to count years before January 1st, 2021, do not have to count toward the 3 years under which you would have to let them in the plan. The Q&A clarifies, though, that Congress did not grant that same exemption for, you know, years prior to 2021 to the vesting rules. Now, generally, you only have to give them their own money, right? They only have to basically allow them to defer. You don't have to allow them to, you know, get other contributions. And normally they are fully vested in their own deferral. They'd have to be. But if for whatever reason you did let them otherwise into sharing plan amounts, have amounts in there that are subject to the vesting rules, this makes clear that you're going to still have to go back and look back to pre-January 1st, 2021 years for the 500 hours, which will count toward the vesting for these part-timers. So you can't ignore those. So you don't get to ignore those prior years. So yes, effectively, because of 3 years rule, I can keep them out until 2024 because I'll need the 21, 22, 23 years over 500 hours. Now I've got my 3 years. I'm good. 24, I let them in. But when they come in 24, anything that is impacted by vesting, I'll have to look back at every year that went above 500 hours, not just those three that got them in the plan. We also have quite a bit of discussion here of qualified birth or adoption expense distributions from IRAs, and they have it divided into part for the individuals and part that relates to the retirement plans. And actually, one of the pieces that relates to the retirement plan really kind of relates to the individual, but we'll talk about this in order, okay? Now, the first thing I tell you is what's the general requirements for it, and that basically comes from the law. And to be a qualified, you know, distribution for a birth or adoption, generally it's up to $5,000 to the participant from the retirement plan during the one-year period beginning on the date when the child is born or the date a legal adoption becomes final. Now, that latter part's got a little trickier because, you know, the legal adoption, quite often there is a time period, a significant time period, where the child may be with the parents, but the adoption has not yet finalized. So you have to wait till finalization before you're allowed to take the money out. That's key. Now, also they say it doesn't count. Remember, the other rule is that the participant will have to give the name, age, and taxpayer ID number of the child on their tax return for the year the distribution is made, right, in order for that to happen. The types of plans that can do it is virtually any type of plan that you know, that you have for the most part. That includes 401A standard employer qualified plans. That includes 403B annuity contracts, 403A annuity plans, governmental 457B plans, and an IRA. So any of those plans can make this distribution. You know, you can take the distribution from any of those plans. It is exempt from the 10% additional tax on early distribution. As you might guess, most parents are probably under age 59 and a half. I know there are some that are older than that, you know, where they have kids and maybe some adopt at that point, but where at least one parent's over 59 and a half. But the reality is that most parents are well below 59 and a half. And so because of that, the rule says, regardless, you don't have to pick up the 10%. However, it points out it is still part of taxable income. So this often confuses people when Congress puts in rules like this. They say, wait, it's a birth or adoption distribution. It gets a tax break. So, you know, if they don't pay the 10% tax, they believe they don't pay the regular tax. Nope. Regular tax is still due in the year of distribution. You're still going to have to pay that tax. Now, we'll talk about the facts. You might be able to recontribute it later, but that's a different issue. They also give information on eligible adoptees. And generally, an eligible adoptee is any individual that you adopt who's not attained age 18, you know, as of the time you adopted them, right, or is physically or mentally incapable of self-support. There is one caveat, though. If you adopt a child, right, who is the child of your spouse, you know, and that often happens, you know, a couple gets married, one or both had children coming into the marriage, and it is possible that they will adopt the other child, you know, they will adopt that child, treat it as their own. If you adopt your spouse's child, you cannot take this distribution. It doesn't count for that purpose. Well, the idea being that's not really the same thing as what they're trying to do here for the expenses involved with a full-blown birth or adoption, right? They're going down that path. They also tell us that for someone who is physically or mentally incapable of self-support, they're really looking at the disability definition under Section 72M to have a test for that. So they walk through that standard rule. Now, they also point out when doing this that the parents can actually, we're going to take two different ways you can get more than $5,000. First thing is you have two parents. Each parent can take $5,000 from their own plan. Now, it has to be from their own plan. So I can get $10,000 to the parents, but dad's got to take $5,000 from a plan he has. It could be his IRA. It could be a 401k that allows it. And mom has to take $5,000 from an IRA or 401k, right? So we have to have that. Both parents, each parent takes their own $5,000, but each parent gets it. And they also make clear, what if there is a multiple birth? So we have a birth of twins. If there are twins, each parent can take $10,000 out. It is $5,000 per parent per child. Okay, so if you have that, so triplets would be $15,000. That could come out per parent, right? So each parent could take $15,000 out of their own retirement accounts, and it would be a qualified adoption distribution, subject to the special rules. Now, the other special rule with qualified adoption distribution is that the parents are allowed to recontribute the amounts to the plan. Now, there are some special requirements here, but it will be treated like a direct rollover from the plan to the receiving entity, which could be itself. Now, one of the examples, obviously, is we could put it in an IRA. Now, the rules also establish no time frame for doing this. That turns out to have been kind of an oversight by Congress. The problem is, if you don't put it back in before the statute for claiming a refund for the year of the distribution closes, while you're allowed to put it back in, it won't be an overcontribution. It also means you're never getting that money back, and you don't get basis for having paid tax on the distribution. There's nothing like that in the rules. So you really have 3 years to put it back in. I will note that under the CARES Act, they seem to have realized this oversight. The CARES Act has a similar ability to put money back in for qualified COVID-19 distributions, but that does have an explicit 3-year cap. Understanding that after 3 years, that ability to put it back in is not really terribly helpful for most people. It will cause problems if they do. So, yeah, we're not going to worry much about that. We also have now the plan side of the qualified birth and adoption rules. So let's talk about the rules for plans. And these are things, even if you don't do a plan, your employees need to kind of realize this, or your clients need to realize this, related to their employer's plans. Number one rule makes it very clear. A qualified plan does not have to allow for such a distribution. And by this, I mean, they don't have to add that you can get a distribution solely because you have a birth or qualified adoption of a child. I do not have to amend my plan to allow for that. Whether an employer will amend a plan to allow for that's open to question. But if they do, there will have to be amendments made, and they're going to be made by the time frame that's provided for in this notice, which generally is going to be for most employers. You've got some exceptions that we'll talk about. But for most employers, you're going to be putting in by the end of the year, beginning on or after January 1st, 2022. For that plan, you're going to have this adopt this amendment in there. And then you begin treating it as if it was already amended. You can do that immediately, but you have to get the amendment in by 2022. The notice also makes it clear, unless the plan knows the participant's lying, that there is no child, or they're adopting, you know, their spouse's child, you know, we know it doesn't qualify. Unless we know it doesn't qualify, or have reason to know it doesn't qualify, we can accept the statement of the parents, you know, the parent that who's a participant, that they're qualified and make the distribution. We don't have to go independently verify it. Again, with the standard caveat, as long as we don't have reason to know or should have reason to know. Obviously, if the person taking the distribution is the 95% shareholder of the company's always going to have reason to know if it doesn't qualify. That's going to be one of the side effects there. So you always have to kind of be aware of that. If a plan does decide to allow distributions based solely on having a qualified birth or adoption, that plan must also allow for the amounts to be recontributed. So that plan cannot say, I will not accept a recontribution of qualified birth and adoption distributions. If you're going to allow the distribution, you have to allow the money to come back in. Now, there's a caveat here, not getting too far ahead of ourselves, because, you know, we'll find out later that that doesn't mean that a participant might not get a distribution. They'll be treated as a qualified birth or adoption distribution from a plan, but they're going to have to qualify otherwise to get it. And if they do, then there is no assurance the plan is going to let them put it back in, right? They give some security, which people get concerned about here in plans. Well, what about all those limitations? You know, like 401k plans, and you know, plans are not defined contribution plans are not allowed to just allow for in-service distributions under all circumstances. They're going to be limited circumstances. They say, oh yeah, yeah, this covers that. Don't worry about that. Those are all fixed. Also, if a plan makes a distribution that qualifies for a rollover and we do it in cash, generally we got to withhold 20%. We have to give everybody all these notices about being able to roll it and all this other stuff. They said, no, for these purposes, this is not a rollover distribution. It's going to force federal withholding. It's not a rollover distribution that is going to require you to give that notice about rollover distributions, that this is a separate thing. It's not that part. When you do get money back, you just treat it as a direct transfer into the plan. So, you know, you don't have to worry about the fact, what about the 60-day rules, et cetera, say, nope, this will be considered a direct transfer from another plan to you. Even though it's not coming from another plan, it will be done that way. That means that DOL or the IRS is not going to be, you know, kind of raking you over the coals because you didn't prove that it was a valid transfer. As a transfer from another plan, you're allowed to take the other plan's representation. It's valid. You're allowed to take the participant's representation. You're not theoretically risking the qualification of the entire plan by doing this. It also provides a relief of sorts for participants where the plan decides we're not touching this. If a participant is otherwise eligible to take a distribution, Maybe they, maybe, you know, when the child was born, they quit the job. And, you know, one of the plan provides on separation from service, you're allowed to take a distribution. If they get that distribution within 1 year after separation, they can treat up to the limit for that particular participant as a qualified birth or adoption distribution, even though the plan did not specifically allow it. So as long as we get a allowed distribution, right, otherwise allowed, we can go ahead and treat that as being a qualified birth or adoption distribution. Now, we can't force the money to go back into the plan we got it from because, like we said, that plan doesn't have to accept these things. But what we can do is then move the money to an IRA. That's not a problem for us, okay, with that. We also have modifications for difficulty of care payments. This was added by the Secure Act. These are those Medicaid-type payments, Medicare, Medicaid payments that are made to foster parents that you don't have to include in income. IRS decides, well, you should still be allowed to put those in retirement funds. So we're going to make non-deductible contributions. Plans are going to have to allow these to come in, but it does say that even though the law says it's treated as an addition to the limitation, you know, that's based on compensation, it's not going to be considered part of compensation for purposes of, so the plan has had to redefine it as compensation, which could then require the plan to make a contribution from the employer's side on these numbers. No, the employer's just allowed to put money in. We use this to kick up the numbers, but unless the employer is making the payment, the employer does not have to add that to contribution to the, they have to add that to what's considered compensation. It's not add to compensation, and you don't have to change your definition of compensation unless you, the employer, are making the payments. If you are, then this does become part of compensation that has to be covered by your plan. They also deferred issuing guidance on how this interacts with the excess contribution tax, indicating that's going to be covered by future guidance because that could get a little messy. So they apparently, and my guess is, it's not in this because they haven't figured out how to make it work yet. So all we know is that's coming later, how the excess contribution rules may work with this. We also had a change here you probably may not have noticed was in the law at the end of 2019, because this was actually found in the Minors Act. Now, the Minors Act was part of that big package at the end of the year that passed at the last day of the year, so which the Secure Act was part of as well. So, you know, it was part of that overall comprehensive omnibus what appropriations bill that came out for 2020. But this added and reduced, allowed plans to reduce in-service distribution limitations or the in-service distribution rules that you could allow employees to take them out as early as age 59 and a half. So the minimum age was reduced to that level. Now, a plan's not required to offer these in-service distributions anyway. And therefore, even if they're already offering it to people age 62, they're not required now to say, no, that goes all the way to 59 and a half. They could set an age that is between 59 and a half and 62. Any of those would work. They just, you know, they're not required. So again, it's one of those issues for your clients who's heard, well, I heard that the age they have to let me take the money out, you know, got dropped 59 and a half. No, they don't have to let you take it out. They never did at 62 either. You know, they could have waited till actual separation from service, you know, hitting retirement age, etc. And that's still true. So if a plan is not modified, it doesn't have to do this. But the IRS also said, you know, currently we put in a rule that allowed you to treat as your normal retirement age. You know, your normal retirement age should be an age that, based on the industry, is one where people often have retired by that age. And they said, but we're going to assume any age up, you know, 62 or later meets those requirements. The IRS said we are not extending that to 59 and a half. 62, which honestly is probably there because it's tied to the early Social Security distribution date. They're saying, well, that qualifies as an early retirement date for everybody. They said 59 won't qualify unless you independently could establish that is a valid retirement date in your industry. So, you know, if you're covering law enforcement officers, yeah, that's probably going to be a valid early retirement date, right? Then that problem means something like that where people would have to get out earlier. But otherwise, just generically, if you're covering librarians, that probably is not going to show that there is a, you know, normal early retirement date in that range. So the plan would have to justify they're not moving that down. Now, they also clarified the amendment dates. Generally, for qualified retirement plans, any amendments to take effect of any of these that either you have to do or you want to take effect immediately, as soon as they could, has to be for the first plan year beginning on or after January 1st, 2022. And for collectively bargained or government plans, that's 2024. Now, for ones you don't have to do, you have to do it within 180 days after you basically have given notice that you're going to be using these rules. So effectively, if you decide to start doing it today, it's still going to be January 1st, 2022, because it's the later of 180 days after you give notice, or the first plan year ending, the first plan year beginning on or after January 1st, 2022, the last day of that year. So generally, we've got till December 31st, 2022. If you meet some of the exceptions, in this case for a collective bargain plan, a government plan, you can move it all the way to 2024. If you are a 403B plan, again, 2022 for most plans, but for public school plans, it's 2024 is your rules. 47B governmental plans, 2024. And you are allowed to operate as if it's already amended. You may be required to for some of these things, but you have to then get the amendments back in place by those dates. Okay, now let's go on. We've got our second change in the 941 this year. The IRS issued dated August the 28th, a brand new Form 941. It is the second change to Form 941 this year due to COVID issues. This particular one implements the August 8th memorandum from the president granting, you know, the payroll tax holiday rules that we're still really having some fun with generally. And we'll ignore that discussion. We had it last week and nothing's changed from that. You know, except that the Treasury, I should add, it was reported Friday by Bloomberg Tax, who was at the conference, that an IRS representative did effectively state employers to have this as an option. That, so the Treasury Secretary said that early on. Now we have the IRS going out in public and saying it. So I think we're very safe of saying it is an employer option, right? And there's no way for an employee to force an employer to do it, at least not on the federal level. And so, you know, we kind of worry about how that works otherwise, but that's there. But we do need some revisions for the 941 to take care of this, because we now are, remember, we are already deferring old age, survivor, and disability insurance, at least optionally, for the employer section. That was part of the CARES Act that later got expanded to even those that got forgiveness of debt by the Paycheck Protection Program Flexibility Act that was passed later. So we're already doing that, and we already modified the 941 to allow for that deferral before. Now we're modifying it because we have this other deferral. That line you use for that deferral will still be used on, will be used to defer the employee portion as well. So all of it's going to go on the same line we're using now. That's clarified by this. They both go on line 13B, and then they add a new line 24 in part 3. We'll tell the IRS how much of that old age, survivor, and disability insurance deferral is the employee deferral. And presumably the IRS will force us to reconcile that and, you know, use that to determine when they'll start penalizing employers who don't get those amounts paid back by May 1st. So we're going to be using it for that form. This is the draft form. That does mean that when we go to do 941s, you know, beginning at the end of this month for the third quarter, we are going to have to wait for the amended form to become, for the draft form to become final. We are hopeful that'll happen before the end of the quarter, but there's always possible it won't. Other thing that happened this week, we have a special case. We have a case, Herman Kuma versus the Greater New York Conference of Seventh-day Adventist Church et al., which was heard from the Southern U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, case number 1:19-CV0848, decided on August the 28th. Now, this is a pastor who had been working at a, you know, Seventh-day Adventist church for 21 years. And he went in and he applied for Social Security and Medicare and was told by Social Security Administration, sorry, pastor, we have no record of any contributions for you on your account. So for the last 21 years, we don't show anything for you. So you don't have enough credits, right? Remember, you have to have a certain minimum number of quarters of coverage is our credits, and they're not really quarters, and we get into that, but you can earn 4 per year. You have to have enough of those credits at a minimum to qualify for any Social Security and a minimum number to qualify for Medicare when you turn age 65. And this pastor was told, sorry, you don't have enough for either. And he said, why not? I've worked all these years. They said, well, you know, we don't have any employer paying in for you for Social Security. Well, the pastor claimed in this lawsuit that the Seventh-day Adventist Church should have treated him as an employee and should have withheld FICA. And so because of that, he obviously was looking for damages from the Seventh-day Adventist Church to compensate him for the fact that he was going to have no medical coverage and not have any Social Security. But the court pointed out that the pastor was, he had an issue. He had a big issue. What's his issue? Well, wages paid to a pastor, to a minister, by a church are specifically exempted. They're not FICA wages. IRC Section 3121B8A specifically excludes them from withholding and payment of FICA. And I should add, this is a mandatory exclusion. This is not optional. Although, to be totally honest, yes, a lot of churches don't understand this. A lot of churches pay it, and I doubt Social Security very often ends up catching the fact that realistically this money shouldn't have been in there, because we'll find out that how you're supposed to do it is unless you qualify for the exemption, like under 1402E1, that you are conscientiously opposed, you've taken a vow of poverty and conscientiously opposed to having this sort of government support program, unless you have had that exemption granted, you have to report those wages, what would be W-2 wages, as self-employment income as a minister and pay self-employment tax. Now, you know, obviously the reverend here did not do that. And he obviously, even if he had been self-employed, you know, you would have reported it there. So clearly he never filed an SE. But this is something that often gets overlooked, right? In essence, ministers, churches do not pay FICA taxes on the wages of ministers. They are specifically exempted by the code from being taxable. Rather, the minister reports it on Schedule SE. In this case, the minister is not qualifying for either because no amounts were ever paid on his behalf. The church wasn't required to pay them, and he never paid the self-employment tax. So just kind of tough luck, right? One of those things to remember, we deal with churches because churches have these special rules. Ministers and churches have lots of weird rules. This is one of them to worry about as well. Finally, the IRS published a brand new webpage, BBA Centralized Partnership Audit Regime, on their website on September 1st. This is a centralized repository for IRS guidance dealing with the brand new Centralized Partnership Audit Regime that's part of the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015 that took effect in 2018 tax years, right? And this page has sections with guidance on filing requirements, the BBC partnership audit notices that you will receive. They have your links to the actual regulations the IRS has published on how these audits run, and any interim guidance, which would be like temporary regulations, notices, other things that they issue to deal with BBA audits. They also have there a table that we reproduced in the printed materials this month, or this week, that has a high-level comparison between the older TEFRA program this replaced and the new BBA, how they're different, how they're the same. Now, remember, big thing to remember right now, though, because we are into September, remember, we have a temporary time period where we could still amend a 2018 or 2019 return, even though it's a BBA partnership. As long as we do that amendment by September 30th, we are able to file an amended return and have the taxpayers, the partners, amend their personal returns or their entity returns, whatever our partners are, do that rather than having to treat this as a BBA, you know, administrative adjustment request and go through that whole messy, long and messy process. So we do have that time frame coming. Once October 1st arrives, your 2018 and 2019 returns, if you have a part, if you find a problem, your partnership return for 18 or 19, you're going to be stuck having to go through the AAR routine unless the partnership opted out of the Bipartisan Budget Act, which of course most have not done. So, you know, most, because it turns out most of them didn't do it, even the ones who were eligible. I think largely because people don't understand what it meant. I found a lot of confusion by CPAs about it who weren't aware, well, what's that? Why does it matter? And yeah, those are all things you really should have down by now. But we'll just mention that to you. We do have a short time frame, though, to still fix 18 and 19 returns if there's a problem. But the deadline runs at the end of September. Yes, I wish they would have extended it through the end of the year, but the IRS didn't. So just be glad we got some relief, even if maybe it's not as long as we would have hoped. Do have some courses coming up for you. You can sign up for it. We will be rebroadcasting the course I did on September the 2nd. On September the 9th in New Jersey, it'll begin at 10 in the morning Eastern Time. It is a replay, so obviously you won't have a live during the broadcast somebody saying the answer to questions, but we will be monitoring questions and getting them back to you if you have if you have any issues. So we'll try to monitor the questions and get an answer back to you as need be. So that'll be going on the 9th. We will do this session as a live session, real live. I'll be there doing it. On September the 22nd, I will do it for Arizona. You can register for on the Arizona Society website. That will run from 12:30 p.m. on the 22nd until 4 p.m. So if you want to go there, it'll be the same basic thing that we did for New Jersey. We'll just be doing it for Arizona. So again, we are open for questions. So if you have any questions, which we had a bunch of in the New Jersey session regarding the PPP loan forgiveness program, you can go ahead and come in there. Other courses I have coming up with New Mexico Society of CPAs. I've got a couple of sessions coming up there. On the 23rd, 2 4-hour sessions. One is the tax implications of the financial accounting rules. This looks at how the revenue recognition rule that we're beginning to pick up, you know, how that impacts you with tax return filings. And then also some of the reverse here, how the rules under 451 added by TEFRA that require us to recognize revenue at least as quickly as we do on the applicable financial statement, how that causes GAAP to end up indirectly influencing us, even if we don't otherwise want to, say, move over to the revenue recognition standard for GAAP for tax purposes, we may be forced to it. So we're going to talk about those two provisions. It'll be a four-hour session. We'll also talk about the accounting, auditing, and tax consideration for the cannabis industry. That'll be the afternoon version of this. We'll talk about, you know, what's the tax issues with this? How does it work? Yes, I know Congress is talking about voting on removing marijuana from the listed from our key list, which makes it a problem that causes our issue here. But unfortunately, that vote currently is only talked about the House voting for it. The Senate has not said they will vote, and I kind of doubt they will. So we'll talk about where we stand there with 280 Cap E and our issues with that and kind of give you some discussion there. Also, the next day, I'll be doing an 8-hour session on basic issues for operating, organizing, and preparing forms for tax-exempt orgs on the 24th. It's an 8-hour session. Both of those are being recorded also by the Society, and you should see those show up in Cal CPA's catalog as well down the line. Cal CPA will rebroadcast those sessions, so you can look for them down the line with those titles. Those are the ones I did in New Mexico, so you'll be able to pick them up there. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 7th, 2020. Right, and I realize the 7th is Labor Day, but you know, we'll still publish it by Monday. You know, you guys want to listen on Labor Day, that's fine. Otherwise, whatever you want to do, we'll go with that. If you have any questions or comments, email me, edzogers@currentfortaxdevelopments.com. That is by far the best way to send me questions about issues that arise in continuing education courses or this broadcast, because I check there when I have time to answer questions that have come in from participants. If you send it to my main address, which I do use for some of the groups I work through, if you send it there, it's likely to sit for a while and may get ignored, especially as you get closer to deadlines. So try to send it to the right one. Twitter, you can follow me there at Ed Zollers on Twitter. So follow me along there. I generally do things there mainly with tax Twitter, post on tax matters, get into tax discussions. So you can see those going on there. Also follow discussions on a number of state societies connect groups for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois. Washington. I look in on their Connect groups. Also, I look in from time to time on the Tax Talk group for Cal CPA. Anybody can join that last group. The other state society groups are generally reserved if you're a member of those state societies. So, but I do check in on those and watch for them. Otherwise, you know, we got another week going. We are heading to the first drop dead deadline on September 15th this year. And remember, the 15th is for your pass-throughs, your S corporations partnerships, generally their calendar year ends. The 30th will be for our trusts and estates that were calendar year ends. And then the 15th of October becomes the deadlines for the C corporations and the individual returns. So that's our staggered dates. Those are still in place for this year. COVID-19 did not change those. So, you know, keep your eye on that. And hopefully, and once we get to October 15th, I'm going to be doing a lot more CPE courses. I will warn you, of course, that a lot of them are going to, are, in fact, at this point in time, I don't think I have confirmed anything that's going to be in person. I think we still have some showing up on the calendars, but nobody has yet actually told us that, oh, yeah, absolutely, this will be live. There's no chance it's going to be webcast. So, you know, I haven't been told yet by somebody, go ahead, we're really doing this. You really are coming. So we'll see. There are some that may go that way before then, but most of them have already been confirmed to swap to webcast. So I'll probably be webcasting at least through the end of December for most courses, but I will try to keep you up to date on what will we have coming up and where they are. So keep your eyes out for that. Otherwise, hopefully I'll see you here next week. We'll see if Congress actually gets together and passes another bill for us. We'll also see if we get any better guidance on the payroll tax holiday. We got all kinds of things that could happen. So we'll just keep our eyes open, and I'll see you then next week for more current federal tax developments.